Hi everyone, I'm Sarah Higgins, Art Papers Executive and Artistic Director. Atlanta-based and globally engaged, Art Papers expands the dialogue around contemporary art and culture by exploring the ways they affect and reflect human experience. You can find a rich archive of interviews, reviews, feature essays, artist projects, and more on artpapers.org. Welcome to the first episode of Echoes, a new monthly series where we spotlight our community of writers and artists who've been central to Art Papers' creative and rigorous coverage over the years. This month, we have Tal Beery and Maxwell Paparella talking about their contributions to our summer 2020 issue, Living and Working. They discuss a range of topics, including art worker unionization efforts, the need for speculative institutional models, and the funding landscape from within the first year of the COVID-19 pandemic. The works they're discussing are linked in the description, and there's also a link if you'd like to support the work of Art Papers by making a donation or purchasing from our shop.
Hi, Tal.
We did it!
Not so bad.
No, how's it going? I've never done this Instagram Live thing before.
Yeah, this is my second time, I think. So we'll see what we can do.
Awesome.
How are you this afternoon?
Nice to meet you, Maxwell. This is nice.
Yeah,
what a great article you wrote. I can't wait to talk about it.
Likewise. Yeah, looking forward to getting into it. So I see we have some folks joining us. Maybe we'll just hem and haw for a few minutes so people can file in.
Very nice. So where are you? Where are you talking from right now?
I'm in Brooklyn. Where are
Brooklyn.
You?
Brooklyn. I'm in upstate Brooklyn. I'm in Sullivan County, New York, in the Catskills.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I've driven through there certainly.
Yeah, yeah.
How long have you been so you're living there?
Yeah, yeah. We've been here for 2.5 years now.
Okay, cool.
Sullivan County is amazing. I work at a wonderful arts organization here called the Hurleyville Performing Arts Center, which is doing really fantastic work. And it's, you know, it's really great. It's such a diverse, vibrant community up here. So I'm really happy to be here. I mean, especially now during the pandemic, it's kind of crazy how it all happened, but, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I hope you and your family have been safe and well, as well as possible, of course.
Thank you. Yours too.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. Let's get into it. We're supposed to talk for about an hour here. We'll be sure to leave some time for questions at the end. So, Tal, can you walk us through your recent piece and maybe also give a bit of background to your practice in general?
Sure. Yeah. Thank you so much for hosting, Maxwell. And thank you to Art Papers, of course, to Sarah Higgins and E.C. Fleming and the whole team. They're really wonderful people. And I'm really honored to be part of this issue. It's such a good one. And it makes a lot of sense to me that you and I are speaking together because our issues overlap so much. I've been working in and around institutions and art for a long time. It's really been my focus for the last bunch of years. And I wanted, in this article, I wanted to kind of put forward a actionable proposal, kind of try to understand what all of the thinking that I've done around art and institutions, what that actually amounts to if I were to, you know, actually take a step forward and propose a policy, you know, propose a policy agenda. And, you know, lo and behold, like it ended up being like a very simple proposal. But I think the article focused on what to me is kind of a paradox that's at the center of our art system today, which is the fact that we don't actually get diversity. We don't actually get a flourishing diversity of viewpoints in the arts. And in particular, we don't get a flourishing diversity of institutional arrangements in the arts when we have or when we rely on a diversity of funders. So in the United States, we have, a private system where we rely on many individual donors to sustain arts institutions. And it turns out that that does not result in heterogeneity or what we would consider to be perhaps like a heterotopia or a kind of a place that actually includes multiple viewpoints. In fact, centralized systems of funding, so government funding for the arts, a single-payer system for the arts, would be more equitable, more inclusive, and create space for the arts to flourish in a way that they don't right now.
Great, thank you. Yeah, I really agree, and I'm looking forward to getting into a lot of that with you in a moment. I'll just try to briefly summarize my own contribution. It is a timeline in essence, so I'm gonna like kind of try to walk us through a bit of the timeline, but obviously there's a lot more detail in the text. So I wrote about what I call the museum union wave, which was a period of rapid, I think we're still in the wave. So it is a period of rapid organization among workers at cultural institutions across the U.S. It begins in early 2019 at the New Museum, at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, at the Tenement Museum here in New York City. But those moments of organization are preceded by some very visible contract negotiations at MoMA, at SF MoMA, and at the Vancouver Art Gallery in the previous year. So all of a sudden, everywhere you look, museums are making, you know, these huge real estate investments. They're increasing their endowments. Their executives have high salaries and sometimes in the high six figures. Meanwhile, their workers are being put in very precarious positions. Many of the workers not making a living wage. They're receiving little or no benefits. There are health and safety concerns in the workplace. Maybe they're not happy more broadly with the way the organization is being run. And so the stage is set for something to happen about that. And then at the end of May 2019, a group calling themselves Art and Museum Transparency begins to circulate a salary share spreadsheet. And so thousands of workers are seeing for the first time what their counterparts at other institutions are making. And then the New Children's Museum staff is organizing in San Diego. The Guggenheim's art handlers are organizing. Security guards at the Frye Art Museum in Seattle are organizing. And the wave quickly spreads to where now, you know, I think we can say that there's about 20, you know, more than 20 institutions just in the past couple of years that have had very serious union efforts. I think it's important to note that this is happening concurrently with a nationwide wave of teacher strikes, as well as other union drives, particularly in the media industry and among graduate students. So kind of, you know, these white collar industries that you that haven't been, you know, thought about as a natural home for unions perhaps in the past are becoming converted. And another piece of context, I think, and I'm hoping that we can, you know, that this will be very relevant to our discussion today, is that art workers are beginning to take a closer look at who is funding their institutions, who sits on the boards. You know, we're seeing these big campaigns to unseat board members, and maybe we'll get more into that. So it's not happening in the union, it's not happening in a vacuum, rather. Unionists are, responding to urgent problems in the workplace, but some also have their eyes set on the levers of power. And I think, you know, briefly, there's some early victories. There are also some disastrous defeats. You know, the Marciano Art Foundation in Los Angeles abruptly shutters rather than allow their staff to unionize. After 8 months of bargaining, the workers at the New Museum get their first contract under threat of strike. And you know, elsewhere we can see moments of success, moments of compromise, and some, you know, some failures. And so March 2020, of course, the outbreak begins, museums close to the public, workers are furloughed, tens of thousands of museum workers across the country are furloughed or laid off. Some unions were able to win payment and healthcare extensions, but you know, those didn't last for long. The pandemic quickly becomes a pretext for union busting, and management really takes the opportunity to clean house. At Frye, they immediately fire the shop steward and eliminate her position so she can't come back even under a return agreement. By the end of the summer, the New Museum has laid off 27% of its full-time staff, including both shop stewards. And so we can see very directly how, you know, this was an opportunity for management to really come in and union bust. So the unions are setting up mutual aid funds and efforts to protect their members. The unions also become organs of dissent during the uprisings this summer, often in stark contrast to the attack that management takes. And here we are. The wave continues. And since I finished working on the timeline, you know, workers at the Philadelphia Museum of Art had voted to unionize. The Milwaukee Art Museum just voted to unionize last month. MFA Boston voted to unionize last month. Filament Lincoln Center, the United Museum Workers at Pittsburgh Carnegie Museums, the Portland Museum of Art is in the midst of a union drive. Poets House here in New York is another one of these Marciano Art Foundation type, you know, tragedies where in the midst of a union drive, management closed the foundation permanently. And so yeah, maybe I'll leave it there for now. My article, this timeline is, you know, doesn't have much in the way of original research, although I'm grateful to, of course, my sources and museums and unions, but also very grateful to the people who were doing firsthand reporting and allowing me to kind of construct a secondary source account where I was trying to collate a lot of this information for the first time and see it all in one place. Okay.
Well, Maxwell, why don't we just get right into it? Because yeah, I got it. You know, during Occupy Wall Street in 2011, I got involved with two arts-related groups there, Arts and Labor and Occupy Museums. And in both instances, we were doing lots of work with unions and considering labor abuses. And there were so many moments. Like, for example, we did this one action at MoMA. And we were calling attention to labor relations. They were actually locking, Sotheby's was locking out its art handlers over a contract dispute, and a few of the board members at MoMA were also on the board of Sotheby's, so there was obvious conflict of interest there. And so, kind of in light of all of these things, we did these actions at MoMA, and as we're leaving, doing these like massive performative actions, you know, we decided to bring the General Assembly into the museum, and that was, I think, a very kind of exciting moment. art workers were, you know, like folks who were taking our tickets at the door, and janitorial staff and whatever were giving us high fives as we were leaving the museum, and kind of looking over their shoulder as they were doing it. And it was an obvious, it was a moment for me where I started to realize that our agitation from outside was actually not antagonistic to the desires and needs of the workers in the institution itself. But I think a lot of people have known that for some time, that there are these issues, you know, and clearly, like, we were just kind of continuing a tradition that had started way before, you know, like we were, particularly like the Art Workers Coalition and the Guerrilla Girls and other folks like that, would really put in a lot of work in shedding light on the ways that finance and culture intersect, and the abuses of finance find their way into abuses in culture, in the culture sector. So I guess I'm wondering, you know, what's different now? Why is all this precipitating now? Are these the results of conversations that started in 2011, 2012, when Occupy Wall Street really started to kind of like shed light on the relations between museum workers and other workers in the cultural, I mean, let's say artists as gig workers and cultural producers and other people in the museum field? Or is this something entirely new, or is it building on something that started, you know, in the last decade?
Yeah. Well, I think, of course, you're right that we're always, you know, building on the work that has come before. And I'm sure a lot of people are looking to, you know, I had a question for you, actually, about, like, to what extent, and we can get to this maybe in a minute, but to what extent the Debt Fair Project might have influenced the campaigns to oust some of these board members, right? Because you've made so visible the holdings of, you know, the portfolios of some of the people who are sitting on the boards of these.
You know, we were one of many other groups, you know, that over the years, I mean, you know, and we were particularly inspired by the Guerrilla Girls, who were able to name names. And I mean, they did it anonymously, of course, but we thought that was absolutely the right thing to be doing right now, is to really choose targets in the culture sector who essentially could be the face of what we consider to be abusive power relations in the sector. You know, yeah. So Debt Fair was one project where we did that, but we had done that before in multiple other projects as well as Occupy Museums. So Debt Fair was one of our projects as Occupy Museums. And I should give a shout out to my crew over there. Without them, the article that I wrote wouldn't be possible. I mean, I've learned so much from them. And Noah Fisher, actually, who I worked with in Occupy Museums, illustrated the article for Art Papers. So shout out to Noah and, of course, to Imani and Kenneth and Arthur, who worked very closely with us.
Yeah, very cool. Those are beautiful images of Noah's. So to get to your question, I think that certainly there's precedent in Occupy and in Guerrilla Girls and further back in, you know, the Art Workers Coalition, the Black Emergency Cultural Coalition in the late 60s. I think also one of the turning points was the Me Too movement and the way that you know, found its way into the art world with the, you know, exposing Knight Landesman for the predator that he is. And I mean, very directly at New Museum, these conversations, the conversations that led to a union drive grew directly out of a sort of conference that the museum hosted on harassment in the cultural sphere. And so I think there you're seeing like a bit of, you know, speaking out of two mouths or something on the part of the museum, where they wanted to be able to address certain issues and while leaving other things aside. But it prompted these questions of, you know, broader issues of equity in the workplace. And so anyway, so there are reports of like some of those first conversations happening right after some of the workers got out of that conference. I think, you know, we could also talk about wage working artists in the greater economy.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
But I think something that sets the museum union wave apart from some of those groups is that there's a lot of, you know, there's a long history of artists advocating for themselves, for better representation, for compensation. And you know, certainly that is something that we should be able to draw solidarity with among all, you know, art workers of various stripes. But here we're seeing like the staffs of museums, some of the, you know, security guards, art handlers, you know, administrators, who are kind of advocating for themselves, maybe for the first time in an organized way, and making visible some of the labor, you know, some of the other labor besides artists, what we understand as artistic labor that creates the art that we see. And so, yeah, I mean, I think the point is not so much that art is labor as like labor is labor, and it should be compensated as such, even when the product.
Right. Right. However, I mean, and I know a lot of the people who, you know, who've been actively agitating at Guggenheim or at the New Museum, and a lot of them are artists. A lot of them are artists who are, you know, have a job at one of these institutions. And what's always seemed to get in the way of some unionization efforts are differences within the workforce, right? You've got these MFAs who are doing art handling at the Guggenheim, and then you've got other folks, you know, just regular people who have jobs at the museum. And I'm wondering, have you, in your reporting, have you found any, has there been any reported tension between these different, like, you know, elements within the body of laborers in museums?
I mean, I think that I think that is, you know, the kind of like sense of exceptionalism that you're talking about that would seem to differentiate, you know, working artists from other laborers, people who don't, you know, configure themselves as artists or whatever, is one of the real hurdles that this movement had to take on as they began to organize themselves.
That's exactly what I'm bringing up. It always seems like there's like a kind of class barrier. You know, I think it's become very obvious, I think, to say that artists tend to occupy a particular class position, and it makes it harder for them to find common ground with other laborers in the industry.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it's heartening to me to hear some of the rhetoric that comes out of these organizing efforts try to counteract that sense that has been, you know, passed down to us that that artists are, you know, imagined to be in many cases, like not always, but imagined to be.
It's not real. It's an imagined place. Yeah, right.
Privilege, right? And that this is exactly the fulcrum that is, you know, under operation where their labor is coerced out from under them, where they're, you know, not compensated because they, it's assumed that they're people of wealth, people of means who don't actually need the money that they make from the work that they do in the arts. So in the arts,
right,
is, you know,
as if, right,
more valuable to them than the paycheck or something. Which is maybe the case for a very small minority of arts workers, but certainly not the majority. And so I think, you know, as they started to have these conversations about compensation, as they were, you know, sharing their salaries amongst them, like that's the first step, really, in many of these union drives, is just like reaching across the desk and asking your coworker, hey, what do you make here? And how long have you been here? And like, how did you get a raise? And what were the protocols? And you start to expose these huge disparities in wages and also find that you're living with the same problems as the person who's working down the hall from you, or who's mopping up, or who's standing in the exhibitions as a security guard or whatever, because essentially is treating you the same way. They're exploiting you as they're exploiting you for your labor power in much the same way.
But there is this, there does seem to have been like a very interesting shift in the way that arts workers have seen themselves and understood their class position in the last few years, especially in relation to museum management. You know, and one of the things that I was looking to do in the article that I wrote was, I've played my part in exacerbating antagonism between artists and let's say lay leaders or donors at major cultural institutions, and I think that in some cases that antagonism is really helpful and useful. But in this particular article, I was really trying to find, or one of the things I was imagining were these two audiences. One was, I hoped to be speaking to artists directly, you know, just as an artist myself, and also to be speaking to arts administrators as an arts administrator myself. You know, I occupy these two positions, and I was trying to speak to both these communities, recognizing that, in fact, there are points that we hold, or at least values that we have in common, and that really, if we really we can come together to advocate with each other for changes that would make the entire sector stronger, you know, that would protect the lives and livelihoods of arts workers, just as they would protect the lives and livelihoods of arts administrators, you know, and ways of shifting the power away from the wealthy in the United States that have only been getting wealthier in recent years.
Sure. And so, yeah, so let's get into the funding model that you propose. I mean, you know, I think you write very convincingly about the failures of the American model of arts funding, which is, of course, like almost exclusively the patronage of capitalists. Like the vast majority of arts funding is coming from private contributions. So can you talk a bit about like why this is a problem? Maybe that's a very obvious question, but what is like the effect on the art that we see, do you think?
Yeah, it's an interesting question because I don't think a lot of people give it all that much thought. Even folks who are activists within the sector, they tend to focus more on the abuses of those in power rather than the system as a whole. And what I've been finding over years is that when you turn your attention to Warren Canders or to these other, you know, industry titans of industry or real estate magnates or whoever the hell you want, that kicking one of these folks off of the board of the Whitney Museum or any other museum, it only replaces your royalty. You know what I'm saying? Like the system stays intact. You're not creating a new system in which you're not ruled. You're just creating the conditions for other rulers to step in. And we really do need to think through what it means to have a funding model that relies on the wealthiest people in our society to sustain the largest cultural institutions in our society, the ones that make the canon, you know. So ultimately, I think what I'm arguing is that to say it in the simplest way possible, as the community of people that hold a majority of the wealth in the United States becomes narrower, their tastes and their values become ever more present within our cultural institutions and within the cultural sector as a whole. That's a strange thing for us to agree to. That's a strange set of relations for us to acquiesce to. You know, those of us who aren't in the position to be making demands on cultural institutions, let's say as they are, as board members are, need to be coming together in some, you know, unionized way, you know, we need to make these efforts to speak in one voice.
Yeah.
And I think that we need to be cognizant of the ways in which cultural institutions are funded. And we need to understand that the ways that cultural institutions are funded affects the art that's shown, affects the culture.
Yeah. I mean, especially it seems to me that in so many cases, these board positions are essentially amount to like insider trading schemes where, you know, the board members are privy to are not only privy to, but in many cases have their hand on the button of, you know, curatorial decisions that are being made by the institutions they chair and can kind of move assets around and collect in such a way that, you know, enhances the value of their holdings prior to, you know, the inevitable like market bump that comes.
That's absolutely true. You know, the thing is though that, you know, what ends up happening in these cultural institutions is in a sense, at least the big ones, is in a sense a bit more pernicious than that. Which is that it isn't that there's kind of obvious collusion always between curatorial decisions and funders. It's more that curators and museum directors, or let's say the directors of cultural institutions, they know more or less what their donors want to fund. They've been having conversations with them for years and years and years. They know what their interests are, and their interests as curators and as directors evolve alongside the interests of their funders. And so what worries me more than overt censorship is not a self-censorship, but a kind of co-evolution of tastes that doesn't account perhaps for the tastes of folks who are not in that class of people who are hoarding a majority of the wealth in the United States.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And that gets us to some of the, you know, fundamental questions at stake here of just who is being served by the arts, you know, whether the museum should feel more like a country club or a commons, you know, some of this.
Well, you made such a great point in your article. You just jumped right in. You know, you said, I don't remember, I can't quote it, but you basically said, like, you know, you've got folks making 6 or 7 figures at the tops of these, you know, employees of these institutions making 6 or 7 figures. The director of the Whitney, I'm not going to say it out loud, but it's a tremendous sum of money. I mean, you can just look it up in their 990. And that's just the salary. That doesn't include all the benefits and the other stuff they get. And you know, they make that money because they're able to raise so much more than that. You know, it's not like they make the money and then they don't bring any value to the organization. The value that they bring is financial.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have a real uphill battle replacing a system like that. Because the only replacement for a system like that is a single payer system for art. And there are a lot of really wonderful organizations out there doing the work to advocate for government, for increased government support. In particular, the new one is Be an Arts Hero. But there are plenty of others, Americans for the Arts, and plenty of others that have been doing this work for many, many years. The sad thing is that in the United States, we have this, the very famous performing arts consultant, Michael Kaiser, makes this great point. He says, the reason our art system looks the way it does is because when the Puritans came to the United States, to them, art was evil. You know, but, you know, it's a real challenge because imagine, you know, there was this great article that came out that was like, we need a Dr. Fauci for the arts. Okay. Now imagine that we had a Dr. Fauci for the arts. And imagine that, you know, the same problems that we had with Andres Serrano's Piss Christ or any of Robert Mapplethorpe's photographs, the ones that kind of sparked the big culture wars that resulted in significant cuts to the NEA, and to other arts funding organizations. Those fights are not going to go away. I mean, we, the United States is a little bit in a bind when it comes to advocating for government support for the arts, especially on a federal level. And yet I don't think it's impossible to advocate for it because we are, because I think a majority of artists believe that it's very important to increase government support for the arts. I think it's true also among arts administrators. I think that we're armed with all of the best arguments you could possibly have for increased government support for the arts. We've got a sector that produces about $800 billion annually for the country as a whole. And, you know, it's about, and as artists, we have tools. We have, we should harness the skills that we have as communicators to really start to make this point. And in other words, like where there is so much antagonism now, I think that arts administrators and arts leaders and artists and arts workers can all come together on this one point. You know, so where there is antagonism, and very rightfully so, there's also an opportunity for us to speak in one voice, which I think could really help potentially in mitigating some of the antagonism, which I think is helpful, but again, I think in some sense undermines a lot of the progress that we could be making in other areas.
Yeah. I have, you know, I have a bit of a, like, you know, a devil on my shoulder that asks, you know, if the U.S. state were to be bankrolling the arts, I mean, not only are you in, are you, you know, sort of subjecting yourself to, again, like the constant culture war of, you know, moderation, you know, between what taxpayers want to see themselves paying for and what artists want to be accomplishing, but perhaps also you're finding yourself, you're putting the arts in a, like a hegemonic position where they're used as a, you know, a token of American imperialism abroad, as they were in the Cold War, right, where the CIA was going through Latin America setting up literary journals and you know, bankrolling their editors and things like this. And so it's, yeah, how do you thread the needle there? Like, what are you, how hands-on
yes.
does it need to be with funding, I guess?
Yes, that is also a concern. But if you think that it's stopped, if you think CIA funding for or State Department funding for the arts has stopped, you're wrong. You know, and in fact, the arts have become such an amazingly effective engine at opening markets and in kind of, let's say, promoting the American system abroad, that the government doesn't have to do as much anymore to sustain it. It's sustained by a culture of investment and you know, Wild West capitalism that it just kind of goes, you know. And as it relates to free speech, I think that is a really important point. I think that's the tough one. And I think what we need to be addressing right now as artists is that there is that as a society, we have a need to invest in art, in artists, in cultural institutions, because we need to develop a common narrative. And without that, without a common narrative, without a set of common values, or let's say values held in common, that we can't sustain our democracy. And we're in a point right now where we've really, in a sense, we haven't hit rock bottom yet, but we're heading there. And if we do hit rock bottom, then we're in a really bad position, you know, potentially very violent outcome. And we see right now, realities diverging really meaningfully. And hopefully arts institutions can be places where, and hopefully artists can facilitate the dialogue, and arts institutions can be the places where that dialogue can be held, where we can hold space for meaningful conversations for healing, you know. And I think, in other words, I think that it is a national imperative to invest in that kind of work. Does that make sense?
No, yeah, it does to me. I mean, yeah, I think there's always the risk with bringing the critique inside, with institutionalizing critique and saying, the role that the arts play within the state apparatus is something that we can plan and account for, and to what extent then are you neutralizing any radical or revolutionary potential for the arts by sort of accounting for it in your model in your planned economy, I guess, in this case.
These are conversations that we definitely need to be having again, because these were conversations that we were having quite a long time ago, when the culture wars were still actually raging. And I think these are conversations that we need to continue having. I think that the alternatives are shit. Like, I think that the argument that government funding for the arts will co-opt or otherwise reduce radicality in the arts is like suggesting that artists should suffer in order to produce good art, you know. And as a child of artists who didn't make all that much money and grew up in kind of in a raw loft space in Lower Manhattan, I'm telling you, like, suffering doesn't make all that much better art than not suffering. You know what I mean? It's like artists shouldn't have to suffer. You know, and our culture shouldn't have to benefit from folks who suffer. You know, that's a strange, pathological mentality. My argument is that we need to be taking care of everybody, and we'll make great art, you know, whether we're taking care of folks or not, you know. And by the way, in the same breath, it's also worth mentioning that some of the greatest, and most, beneficial reforms for the arts sector are things like a $15 minimum wage, or universal basic income, or universal health care, And, you know, what's so remarkable about the article you wrote, and hopefully we can turn back to it now, is that it really does represent a moment in which art workers are recognizing their position in the economy as workers, and that they are, and that by doing so, perhaps, we can better advocate for policies that would affect more of us. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Do you see that too?
Yes. I mean, yeah, I think that I guess my interest in, the museum union wave is so much because it aligns art workers with the rest of the working class, and allows the United, the Union of Auto Workers is representing most of these, or many of these museum unions here in New York, and it really puts people, in Seattle there were art museum security guards on the picket lines with nurses across the street, and draws these broad lines of solidarity that we're able to activate upon, and gets away from some of the exceptionalism that we've been taught as regards the arts, and moves us to a place where we are, operating on class priorities, right? And able to, as you say, able to speak in one voice with our fellows. And that strikes me as a tactic, right? Like that's part of how we win the world we want to see, is that we need our workplaces to be organized. Maybe to get back to, we've been talking a little bit more abstractly, but maybe we could begin to speak a little bit more concretely about how we get there from here, and how we, if we want to see a public, if we want to see a single payer system for the arts, then what do we do to create the crisis for capital that's going to take? As you're saying that there's a bit of, it's one thing to see people attacking individual board members, but of course there's always someone ready to come up and fill their place. But I wonder, maybe you'll have some perspective of this as someone who works as an arts administrator as well, very large institutions, we can make a distinction between very large institutions that suck up a lot of the arts funding and small ones, small and medium-sized ones, but whether there is some, I feel like there's maybe a sense of concern in the halls of power of the art world around the unseating of Kanders and the campaign against the Sacklers and, some of these other, Tannenbaum at MoMA, who's a profiteer of the Puerto Rican debt crisis, and what's his name at the Shed, who was the Trump donor. I wonder whether some of those, picking some of the most, blatantly, ludicrously evil people out of these boards, whether we don't move towards, whether that doesn't shake the foundation a little bit and make people think twice before, I think this is one of the cases where the slippery slope is maybe secretly right in a way. And this is actually what the movement secretly or otherwise, I guess, want for itself, is that, museums are, of course, there's the case to be made of, all money is blood money, and, you can get rid of this guy, but there's always going to be someone behind him, and, what do you really, you kind of look in the horse in the mouth or whatever, just stick to your remit, and we'll keep floating this thing. But I think that the critique is more sophisticated than people give it credit for. It wants to fundamentally disrupt the way that museums do business. it understands that it's creating a problem for them, that it's not going to be easy for them to convince, you know, board members to remain sometimes when their houses are being picketed and when they're being, you know, very publicly exposed. This is meant to be the way that they launder their reputations, right? And often their money as well, is that they run it through the ringer of the art world and they've got their name on a hall in at the Met. And, you know, so there's some appearance of respectability about the enterprise, even though they're, you know, creating the opioid epidemic or, you know, whatever else, they're real estate magnates. So anyway, I wonder if this is turning into a question, but I guess what, you know, is, so it, can this be seen, can that kind of activity that does like sort of demonize specific players in the boardroom be seen as a more structural tactic to move us towards something where public funding becomes necessary, right?
I agree with you, and I really like the way you said that. I really like the way that you presented your thought process there, because it really is true that a lot of the protests organized by Decolonize This Place against Warren Kanders, just as an example, but also by Nan Golden and her group Pain against the Sacklers, I think it really does. I think board members are thinking twice before joining now, or let's say joining publicly. I think that ultimately it is putting increased pressure on leaders and cultural institutions to find funding elsewhere. And hopefully what that will result in is increased pressure to lobby government for support. Yeah. But it remains, I think it is one of the tactics for sure. We can't though be satisfied with representation as a be all end all. You know what I'm saying? Like if we have wealthy people from all colors and backgrounds on these boards, I don't think that sufficiently solves the problem. Does that make sense? Because I think that because I think it is true that there isn't all that much clean money out there. Imani Jacqueline Brown, one of our collaborators in Occupy Museums, she spearheaded a project during Debt Fair to look at every member of the board and their connections to a variety of industries, whether those were military industrial industries or fossil fuel industries or, you know, a variety of really crappy industries. Literally all of them were tied up in, you know, I think in some accounts, you know, exploitative, earth-destroying, community-destroying stuff. You know, but that's just the nature of our economy today. I don't think you reach those levels of wealth without having your money come from those places. And it's just the way it is. So we really do need to be thinking not about, you know, but there is one place where clean money comes from, and that's government. And I think that that's true. I just want to make that point very clearly. I think that government money is clean money because that's money that we've agreed in common to pool together and to make decisions about democratically together. I know that that sounds a bit idealistic, but I think that's the best we've got right now. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I see government in some sense as a kind of union. It's a union you can't quite get out of, you know? But these efforts to come together and to define the collectivities within which we choose to operate and within which we choose to regulate our engagement with each other and with the economy, I think those are really important right now to be explicit about. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it really
does. I think I lost myself in the middle of that sentence. But we should open it up to questions, shouldn't we? It's been an incredible conversation, but it's like... I have a bunch of other questions for you too. Like maybe let's open it up to questions. And then, but in the meantime, as we're getting folks to put questions in there, I have one question for you, which is, have there been any institutions out there, large arts institutions out there, that have made public statements in support of unionization efforts and or unionization efforts in their own institutions or at other institutions?
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to be corrected if I'm wrong, but my sense is no, that part of what's been so illustrative about this moment of unionization in the art world is that there was some sense that management might not act like management, right? That there's sort of this, the principle of working in the arts is that, you know, many of us at least have come to the arts through an education that, a liberal education that prioritized egalitarianism and a certain kind of politics and this and that. And that, you know, we thought that we were maybe all engaged in the same kind of enterprise, and that of course, and you know, that the market was an unfortunate part of that, or like, it led us to compromise maybe in that way. But that if we could all get together and you know, if a workforce got together and said what they needed, that that, you know, the museum director would be amenable to that. And I think we really saw that that's not the case. There was massive backlash across the board. As I said, some foundations were closing their doors permanently rather than allow their staff to unionize, and management was just being management in that sense. That's what you see in any union effort. I think you saw the rhetoric change within the union as they saw the backlash. Mm. And, you know, this is probably a too broad a correlation to make, but I think that's useful, actually. I think that we saw, you know, in the uprisings this summer, so many people get radicalized as a result of the police riots that responded to the uprising, and that, you know, that backlash illustrates the tension of power that lies at the heart of the matter. That there's like this expectation of that humanity will emerge out of these, you know, fundamental material contradictions, and when it doesn't, and when we see, rampant abuse of power instead, there's shock and horror and like really a willingness to maybe do something about that. I'm seeing that we have at least one question in the chat. Live Love Chastity is asking, do you think the solution would be forming smaller community-based art networks to counter the bias of the art industry? And so maybe I'll give that to you, Tal, if you don't mind.
I think yes. I mean, yes, but, I mean, I guess it's, the answer is always the same for me with when it comes to solutions. You know, it's like, yes, but how do we want to fund these? You know, I'm personally invested in developing a network of arts presenters in the county where I live, in Sullivan County. I really want it to happen for a variety of reasons. I think we're a lot stronger together. I think we mobilize more resources together. I think it's wonderful to do it. However, the question always becomes, who administers it? Which arts institution has to shoulder the burden of paying for the person's time to take that on? Where does that money come from? You know? And how we develop those partnerships is really important. I mean, ultimately, I'm hoping that we can get some funding from our county or from the state to make that happen. But it's not a guarantee at all, because it doesn't exist so much elsewhere yet. You know, we would be doing something pretty new, I guess. I mean, on some level, I think that's all. I would love to consider funding models for community-based art networks, and try to understand more how those can replace some of the larger institutions that we've come to rely on. But, you know, that's also to be said, by the way, that there are plenty of arts community-based arts networks now. And many of them are thriving. And it's really important to note that the arts system relies on a giant number of small and mid-sized arts organizations in every community around the world, around the country. I think that the trouble is that it's really hard to fund those institutions. The smaller institutions tend to be much harder to fund. And the NEA used to be, the National Endowment for the Arts, used to be the main funder for these rural arts organizations, for arts organizations that supported the work of non-white artists and supported non-white audiences. And when the NEA is weak, we have less funding for those kinds of organizations. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, my sense is that that's exactly right, and that that's what government funding should be used for. But unfortunately, we've seen, I think the statistic is the top 1% of arts institutions are taking, in terms of their annual operating budget, are taking more than 50% or just about 50% of the total government funding for the arts in this country. And so you see like the same kind of disparity as you see among income or among wealth in this country. And who it leaves out is folks for whom rural communities of color, like you're saying, those for whom their consumption of the arts could never function in a market economy, or is not well served by like a market mentality, really.
Right. Yeah, it's less well served. I think what we're talking about is it has to do a lot with funding trends. Rather than funding absolutes, you know what I mean? It just so happens to be the case that that funders prefer, big funders with lots of money, prefer to fund particular kinds of organizations. But it's not always the case. There are plenty of exceptions to the rule. And I think when we're talking about funding dynamics, we need to be cognizant of the fact that we're talking about percentages, and we're not necessarily talking about absolutes. People will always bring up exceptions, but it's really important to understand that these are the trends, and that the trends lead towards consolidation in the industry rather than the growth and flourishing of a multiplicity of perspectives and structures, which is really, I think, where we need to be heading. And I think that as we move towards more unionized funding, unionized labor forces, I'm interested to know, are there a multiplicity of approaches there, or are we really focused on one direction? I guess this will be the last question because we're at 2:00.
So sorry, could you rephrase it a little bit, like whether there could be more than one object for the union to?
I guess I wonder, do these labor disputes typically follow the same path, and are they all aimed at the same kinds of labor relations, or developing the same kinds of labor relations in all of the institutions overall? Are we aiming for a monolith, for a series of protections that's kind of blanket for everybody? Or are we creating situations where individual unionized staffs at individual arts institutions can negotiate individually with management? What's helpful? Like, is it helpful to have a multiplicity of approaches or a single approach? I can see the benefits of both.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a much broader question about unions in general, right? Whether we should look to the European model in which industry standards are negotiated fairly centrally for the most part, or whether we continue with our kind of the rugged individualism of America, in which every factory, every shop, every museum is fighting their own battles. And I won't presume to say which route we should take. I do think you know, a big part of my interest was seeing where unions of art workers were kind of stepping past the traditional concerns of unions and such as compensation and work, you know, workplace protections and benefits and these things like this that maybe would be more, you know, we could imagine like some centralized standards for. And moving into, you know, the new museum won the right to make an annual presentation to a subcommittee of the Board of Trustees. And so, right, it's not much, but you get a sense of where their sights are set and that there is this kind of, unhappiness with the way the power is being allocated and this desire to, you know, fundamentally alter the decision-making structure of the institution and, you know, even down to, like, questioning curatorial decisions, perhaps, or, like, these, you know, these kind of very traditional ways in which, you know, power is distributed. So yeah, that's, I mean, you know, that's, I think, maybe an interesting question for me is where do we go from here? Like what demands can we make, specifically perhaps as art workers beyond, you know, finding solidarity with others of the working class and having like broad political goals, but are there specific goals in the culture industry that we can be working towards as well. And I think, you know, public funding for the arts is certainly a very convincing, you've made a convincing case for that to be one of them. So, all right, I think we're getting the hook.
Thank you so much, everybody. Thank you for joining us. Thank you to Art Papers. Thank you, Maxwell.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to meet, pleasure to read your piece, and look forward to speaking more in the future, I hope.
Yes. Thank you so much.
So long, all.
This episode brought to you by The Supermarket, a new arts and creative event space in Ponce Highlands, Atlanta. With two art galleries, two performance spaces, and more coming soon, The Supermarket is a constantly evolving artist design space here to make your event unique and successful. Visit them online at supermarketatl.com and visit them IRL this Halloween for an unforgettable and unholy experience. This episode also supported by Stoveworks. Stoveworks is a contemporary art space in Chattanooga, Tennessee. It offers three core programs: residency, exhibitions, and public programming. Their goal is to cultivate a climate and culture that stimulates curiosity among its communities, enthusiasm for exchange, and openness to new ideas and contrasting perspectives. Reanimator, curated by Elzavita Snyderman and Anthony DiCenza, is on view until November 9th in the main gallery, and photographic works by William Johnson are on view in the side gallery. All of their programs are free and open to the public, so check out their exhibitions.